The Bhagavad Gita, however, points out that the methods of yoga are all embracive. Its techniques are not meant only for certain types and temperaments, such as those few who incline toward the monastic life. Yoga requires no formal allegiance. Because the yogic science satisfies a universal need, it has a natural universal applicability. A true yogi may remain dutifully in the world, there he is like butter on water, and not like the easily diluted milk of unchurned and undisciplined humanity. To fulfill one's earthly responsibilities is indeed the higher path, provided the yogi, maintaining a mental uninvolvement with egotistical desires, plays his part as a willing instrument of God. There are a number of great souls, living in American or European or other non-Hindu bodies today who, though they may never have heard the words yogi and swami, are, yet true exemplars of those terms. Through their disinterested service to mankind, or through their mastery over passions and thoughts, or through their single-hearted love of God, or through their great powers of concentration, they are, in a sense, yogis. They have set themselves the goal of yoga self-control. These men could rise to even greater heights if they were taught the definite science of yoga, which makes possible a more conscious direction of one's mind and life. Yoga has been superficially misunderstood by certain Western writers, but its critics have never been its practitioners. Among many thoughtful tributes to yoga may be mentioned one by Dr. C.G. Jung, the famous Swiss psychologist. When a religious method recommends itself as scientific, it can be certain of its public in the West. Yoga fulfills this expectation, Dr. Jung writes. Quite apart from the charm of the new, and the fascination of the half-understood, there is good cause for yoga to have many adherents. It offers the possibility of controllable experience, and thus satisfies the scientific need of facts, and besides this, by reason of its breadth and depth, its venerable age, its doctrine and method, which include every phase of life, it promises undreamed of possibilities. Every religious or philosophical practice means a psychological discipline, that is, a method of mental hygiene. The manifold, purely bodily procedures of yoga also mean a physiological hygiene which is superior to ordinary gymnastics and breathing exercises, inasmuch as it is not merely mechanistic and scientific, but also philosophical. In its training of the parts of the body, it unites them with the whole of the spirit, as is quite clear, for instance, in the pranayama exercises where prana is both the breath and the universal dynamics of the cosmos. When the thing which the individual is doing is also a cosmic event, the effect experienced in the body, the innervation, unites with the emotion of the spirit, the universal idea, and out of this there develops a lively unity which no technique, however scientific, can produce. Yoga practice is unthinkable, and would also be ineffectual, without the concepts on which yoga is based. It combines the bodily and the spiritual with each other in an extraordinarily complete way. In the East, where these ideas and practices have developed, and where for several thousand years an unbroken tradition has created the necessary spiritual foundations, yoga is, as I can readily believe, the perfect and appropriate method of fusing body and mind together so that they form a unity which is scarcely to be questioned. This unity creates a psychological disposition which makes possible intuitions that transcend consciousness. The Western day is indeed nearing when the inner science of self-control will be found as necessary as the outer conquest of nature. This new atomic age will see men's minds sobered and broadened by the now scientifically indisputable truth that matter is in reality a concentrate of energy. Finer forces of the human mind can and must liberate energies greater than those within stones and metals, lest the material atomic giant, newly unleashed, turn on the world in mindless destruction. Chapter 25. Brother Anantu and Sister Nalini cannot live, the sands of his karma for this life have run out. These inexorable words reached my inner consciousness as I sat one morning in deep meditation. Shortly after I had entered the Swami order, I paid a visit to my birthplace, Gorakhpur, as a guest of my elder brother Ananta. A sudden illness confined him to his bed. I nursed him lovingly. The solemn inward pronouncement filled me with grief. I felt that I could not bear to remain longer in Gorakhpur, only to see my brother removed before my helpless gaze. Amidst uncomprehending criticism from my relatives, I left India on the first available boat. It cruised along Burma and the China Sea to Japan. I disembarked at Kobe, where I spent only a few days. My heart was too heavy for sightseeing. On the return trip to India, the boat touched at Shanghai. The Dr. Misra, the ship's physician, guided me to several curio shops, where I selected various presents for Sri Yukteswar and my family and friends. For Anantu I purchased a large carved bamboo piece. No sooner had the Chinese salesman handed me the bamboo souvenir than I dropped it on the floor, crying out, "I have bought this for my dear dead brother." A clear realization had swept over me that his soul was just being freed in the infinite. The souvenir was sharply and symbolically cracked by its fall. Amidst sobs, I wrote on the bamboo surface, "For my beloved Ananta, now gone." 237. My companion, the doctor, was observing these proceedings with a sardonic smile. "Save your tears," he remarked. "Why shed them until you are sure he is dead?" When our boat reached Calcutta, Dr. Misra again accompanied me. My youngest brother Bhishu was waiting to greet me at the dock. "I know Ananta has departed this life," I said to Bhishu, before he had had time to speak. "Please tell me, and the doctor here, when Ananta died." Bhishu named the date, which was the very day that I had bought the souvenirs in Shanghai. "Look here," Dr. Misra ejaculated. "Don't let any word of this get around. The professors will be adding a year's study of mental telepathy to the medical course, which is already long enough." Father embraced me warmly as I entered our Agarpur Road home. "You have come," he said tenderly. Two large tears dropped from his eyes. Ordinarily undemonstrative, he had never before shown me these signs of affection. Outwardly the grave father, inwardly he possessed the melting heart of a mother. In all his dealings with the family, his dual parental role was distinctly manifest. Soon after Ananta's passing, my younger sister Nalini was brought back from death's door by a divine healing. Before relating the story, I will refer to a few phases of her earlier life. The childhood relationship between Nalini and myself had not been of the happiest nature. I was very thin, she was thinner still. Through an unconscious motive or complex which psychiatrists will have no difficulty in identifying, I often used to tease my sister about her cadaverous appearance. Her retorts were equally permeated with the callous frankness of extreme youth. Sometimes mother intervened, ending the childish quarrels, temporarily, by a gentle box on my ear, as the elder ear. Time passed, Nalini was betrothed to a young Calcutta physician, Panchanan Bose. He received a generous dowry from father, presumably, as I remarked to sister, too. Anantu and Nalini compensate the bridegroom-to-be for his fate in allying himself with a human bean pole. Elaborate marriage rites were celebrated in due time. On the wedding night, I joined the large and jovial group of relatives in the living room of our Calcutta home. The bridegroom was leaning on an immense gold-brocaded pillow, with Nalini at his side. A gorgeous purple silk sari could not, alas, wholly hide her angularity. I sheltered myself behind the pillow of my new brother-in-law and grinned at him in friendly fashion. He had never seen Nalini until the day of the nuptial ceremony, when he finally learned what he was getting in the matrimonial lottery. Feeling my sympathy, Dr. Bose pointed unobtrusively to Nalini, and whispered in my ear, "Say, what's this?" "Why, doctor," I replied, "it is a skeleton for your observation." Convulsed with mirth, my brother-in-law and I were hard put to it to maintain the proper decorum before our assembled relatives. As the years went on, Dr. Bose endeared himself to our family, who called on him whenever illness arose. He and I became fast friends, often joking together, usually with Nalini as our target. "It is a medical curiosity," my brother-in-law remarked to me one day. "I have tried everything on your lean sister: cod liver oil, butter, malt, honey, fish, meat, eggs, tonics. Still she fails to bulge even 1/100th of an inch. We both chuckled. A few days later I visited the Bose home. My errand that took only a few minutes, I was leaving, unnoticed, I thought, by Nalini. As I reached the front door, I heard her voice, cordial but commanding. Brother, come here. You are not going to give me the slip this time. I want to talk to you. I mounted the stairs to her room. To my surprise, she was in tears. Dear brother, she said, let us bury the old hatchet. I see that your feet are now firmly set on the spiritual path. I want to become like you in every way. She added hopefully, you are now robust in appearance, can you help me? My husband does not come near me, and I love him so dearly. But still more I want to progress in God realization, even if I must remain thin and unattractive. My heart was deeply touched at her plea. Our new friendship steadily progressed. One day she asked to become my disciple. Train me in any way you like. I put my trust in God instead of tonics. She gathered together an armful of medicines and poured them down the roof drain. As a test of her faith, I asked her to omit from her diet all fish, meat, and eggs. After several months, during which Nalini had strictly followed the various rules I had outlined, and had adhered to her vegetarian diet in spite of numerous difficulties, I paid her a visit. Sis, you have been conscientiously observing the spiritual injunctions, your reward is near. I smiled mischievously. How plump do you want to be, as fat as our aunt who hasn't seen her feet in years? No. But I long to be as stout as you are, I replied solemnly. By the grace of God, as I have spoken truth always, I speak truly now. Through the divine blessings, your body shall verily change from today. In 1 month it shall have the same weight as mine. These words from my heart found fulfillment. In 30 days, Nalini's weight equaled mine. The new roundness gave her beauty, her husband fell deeply in love. Their marriage, begun so inauspiciously, turned out to be ideally happy. On my return from Japan, I learned that during my absence Nalini had been stricken with typhoid fever. I rushed to her home, and was aghast to find her reduced to a mere skeleton. She was in a coma. Before her mind became confused by illness, my brother-in-law told me, she often said, if Brother Mukunda were here, I would not be faring thus. He added despairingly, the other doctors and myself see no hope. Blood dysentery has set in, after her long bout with typhoid. I began to move heaven and earth with my prayers. Engaging an Anglo-Indian nurse, who gave me full cooperation, I applied to my sister various yoga techniques of healing. The blood dysentery disappeared. But Dr. Bose shook his head mournfully. She simply has no more blood left to shed. She will recover, I replied stoutly. In 7 days her fever will be gone. A week later I was thrilled to see Nalini open her eyes and gaze at me with loving recognition. From that day her recovery was swift. Although she regained her usual weight, she bore one sad scar of her nearly fatal illness, her legs were paralyzed. Indian and English specialists pronounced her a hopeless cripple. The incessant war for her life which I had waged by prayer had exhausted me. I went to Serampore to ask Sri Yukteswar's help. His eyes expressed deep sympathy as I told him of Nalini's plight. Your sister's legs will be normal at the end of 1 month. He added, let her wear, next to her skin, a band with an unperforated 2-carat pearl, held on by a clasp. I prostrated myself at his feet with joyful relief. Sir, you are a master, your word of her recovery is enough, but if you insist I shall immediately get her a pearl. My guru nodded. Yes, do that. He went on to correctly describe the physical and mental characteristics of Nalini, whom he had never seen. Sir, I inquired, is this an astrological analysis? You do not know her birthday or hour, Sri Yukteswar smiled. There is a deeper astrology, not dependent on the testimony of calendars and clocks. Each man is a part of the Creator, or cosmic man. He has a heavenly body as well as one of earth. The human eye sees the physical form, but the inward eye penetrates more profoundly, even to the universal pattern of which each man is an integral and individual part. I returned to Calcutta and purchased a pearl for Nalini. A month later, her paralyzed legs were completely healed. Sister asked me to convey her heartfelt gratitude to my guru. He listened to her message in silence. But as I was taking my leave, he made a pregnant comment. "Your sister has been told by many doctors that she can never bear children. Assure her that in a few years she will give birth to two daughters." Some years later, to Nalini's joy, she bore a girl, followed in a few years by another daughter. "Your master has blessed our home, our entire family," my sister said. "The presence of such a man is a sanctification on the whole of India. Dear brother, please tell Sri Yukteswarji that, through you, I humbly count myself as one of his Kriya Yoga disciples." Chapter 26. The Science of Kriya Yoga. The science of Kriya Yoga, mentioned so often in these pages, became widely known in modern India through the instrumentality of Lahiri Mahasaya, my guru's guru. The Sanskrit root of Kriya is Kri, to do, to act and react. The same root is found in the word karma, the natural principle of cause and effect. Kriya Yoga is thus union, yoga, with the infinite through a certain action or rite. A yogi who faithfully follows its technique is gradually freed from karma or the universal chain of causation. Because of certain ancient yogic injunctions, I cannot give a full explanation of Kriya Yoga in the pages of a book intended for the general public. The actual technique must be learned from a Kriyaban or Kriya Yogi. Here a broad reference must suffice. Kriya Yoga is a simple, psychophysiological method by which the human blood is decarbonized and recharged with oxygen. The atoms of this extra oxygen are transmuted into life current to rejuvenate the brain and spinal centers. By stopping the accumulation of venous blood, the yogi is able to lessen or prevent the decay of tissues. The advanced yogi transmutes his cells into pure energy. Elijah, Jesus, Kabir and other prophets were past masters in the use of Kriya or a similar technique, by which they caused their bodies to dematerialize at will. Kriya is an ancient science. Lahiri Mahasaya received it from his guru, Babaji, who rediscovered and clarified the technique after it had been lost in the dark ages. The Kriya Yoga which I am giving to the world through you in this 19th century, Babaji told Lahiri Mahasaya, is a revival of the same science which Krishna gave, millenniums ago, to Arjuna, and which was later known to Patanjali, and to Christ, Saint John, Saint Paul, and other disciples. Kriya Yoga is referred to by Krishna, India's greatest prophet, in a stanza of the Bhagavad Gita, offering inhaling breath into the outgoing breath, and offering the outgoing breath into the inhaling breath. The yogi neutralizes both these breaths. He thus releases the life force from the heart and brings it under his control. The interpretation is, the yogi arrests decay in the body by an addition of life force, and arrests the mutations of growth in the body by apan eliminating current. Thus neutralizing decay and growth, by quieting the heart, the yogi learns life control. Krishna also relates that it was he, in a former incarnation, who communicated the indestructible yoga to an ancient illuminato, Vivasvat, who gave it to Manu. The great legislator. He, in turn, instructed Ikshwaku, the father of India's solar warrior dynasty. Passing thus from one to another, the royal yoga was guarded by the rishis until the coming of the materialistic ages. A section then, due to priestly secrecy and man's indifference, the sacred knowledge gradually became inaccessible. The science of Kriya Yoga. Kriya Yoga is mentioned twice by the ancient sage Patanjali, foremost exponent of yoga, who wrote, "Kriya Yoga consists of body discipline, mental control, and meditating on Om." Patanjali speaks of God as the actual cosmic sound of Om heard in meditation. A Om is the creative word. The sound of the vibratory motor. Even the yoga beginner soon inwardly hears the wondrous sound of Om. Receiving this blissful spiritual encouragement, The devotee becomes assured that he is in actual touch with divine realms. Patanjali refers a second time to the life control or kriya technique. Thus, liberation can be accomplished by the pranayama, which is attained by disjoining the course of inspiration and expiration. St. Paul knew kriya yoga, or a technique very similar to it, by which he could switch life currents to and from the senses. He was therefore able to say, "Verily, I protest by our rejoicing which I have in Christ, I die daily." Vertical bar, by daily withdrawing his bodily life force, he united it by yoga union with the rejoicing, eternal bliss, of the Christ consciousness. In that felicitous state, he was consciously aware of being dead to the delusive sensory world of Maya. In the initial states of God contact, Sabbikalpa Samadhi, the devotee's consciousness merges with the cosmic spirit, his life force is withdrawn from the body, which appears dead, or motionless and rigid. The yogi is fully aware of his bodily condition of suspended animation. As he progresses to higher spiritual states, Nirvikalpa Samadhi, however, he communes with God without bodily fixation, and in his ordinary waking consciousness, even in the midst of exacting worldly duties. Kriya Yoga is an instrument through which human evolution can be quickened, Sri Yukteswar explained to his students. The ancient yogis discovered that the secret of cosmic consciousness is intimately linked with breath mastery. This is India's unique and deathless contribution to the world's treasury of knowledge. The life force, which is ordinarily absorbed in maintaining the heart pump, must be freed for higher activities by a method of calming and stilling the ceaseless demands of the breath. The Kriya Yogi mentally directs his life energy to revolve, upward and downward, around the six spinal centers: medullary, cervical, dorsal, lumbar, sacral, and coccygeal plexuses, which correspond to the 12 astral signs of the zodiac, the symbolic cosmic man. 1/2 minute of revolution of energy around the sensitive spinal cord of man effects subtle progress in his evolution. That 1/2 minute of kriya equals 1 year of natural spiritual unfoldment. The astral system of a human being, with 6, 12 bipolarity, inner constellations revolving around the sun of the omniscient spiritual eye, is interrelated with the physical sun and the 12 zodiacal signs. All men are thus affected by an inner and an outer universe. The ancient rishis discovered that man's earthly and heavenly environment, in 12-year cycles, push him forward on his natural path. The scriptures aver that man requires 1,000,000 years of normal, diseaseless evolution to perfect his human brain sufficiently to express cosmic consciousness. 1,000 kriya practiced in 8 hours gives the yogi, in 1 day, the equivalent of 1,000 years of natural evolution, 365,000 years of evolution in 1 year. In 3 years, a kriya yogi can thus accomplish by intelligent self-effort the same result which nature brings to pass in 1,000,000 years. The kriya shortcut, of course, can be taken only by deeply developed yogis. With the guidance of a guru, such yogis have carefully prepared their bodies and brains to receive the power created by intensive practice. The kriya beginner employs his yogic exercise only 14 to 28 times, twice daily. A number of yogis achieve emancipation in 6 or 12 or 24 or 48 years. A yogi who dies before achieving full realization carries with him the good karma of his past kriya effort. In his new life he is harmoniously propelled toward his infinite goal. The body of the average man is like a 50-watt lamp, which cannot accommodate the billion watts of power roused by an excessive practice of kriya. Through gradual and regular increase of the simple and foolproof methods of kriya, man's body becomes astrally transformed day by day, and is finally fitted to express the infinite potentials of cosmic energy, the first materially active expression of spirit. Kriya Yoga has nothing in common with the unscientific breathing exercises taught by a number of misguided zealots. Their attempts to forcibly hold breath in the lungs is not only unnatural but decidedly unpleasant. Kriya, on the other hand, is accompanied from the very beginning by an accession of peace, and by soothing sensations of regenerative effect in the spine. The ancient yogic technique converts the breath into mind. By spiritual advancement, one is able to cognize the breath as an act of mind, a dream breath. Many illustrations could be given of the mathematical relationship between man's respiratory rate and the variations in his states of consciousness. A person whose attention is wholly engrossed, as in following some closely knit intellectual argument, or in attempting some delicate or difficult physical feat, automatically breathes very slowly. Fixity of attention depends on slow breathing. Quick or uneven breaths are an inevitable accompaniment of harmful emotional states, fear, lust, anger. The restless monkey breathes at the rate of 32 times a minute, in contrast to man's average of 18 times. The elephant, tortoise, snake and other animals noted for their longevity have a respiratory rate which is less than man's. The tortoise, for instance, who may attain the age of 300 years, breathes only 4 times per minute. The rejuvenating effects of sleep are due to man's temporary unawareness of body and breathing. The sleeping man becomes a yogi. Each night he unconsciously performs the yogic rite of releasing himself from bodily identification, and of merging the life force with healing currents in the main brain region and the 6 subdynamos of his spinal centers. The sleeper thus dips unknowingly into the reservoir of cosmic energy which sustains all life. The voluntary yogi performs a simple, natural process consciously, not unconsciously like the slow-paced sleeper. The kriya yogi uses his technique to saturate and feed all his physical cells with undecaying light and keep them in a magnetized state. He scientifically makes breath unnecessary, without producing the states of subconscious sleep or unconsciousness. By kriya, the outgoing life force is not wasted and abused in the senses, but constrained to reunite with subtler spinal energies. By such reinforcement of life, the yogi's body and brain cells are electrified with the spiritual elixir. Thus he removes himself from studied observance of natural laws, which can only take him by circuitous means as given by proper food, sunlight, and harmonious thoughts to a million-year goal. It needs 12 years of normal healthful living to effect even slight perceptible change in brain structure, and a million solar returns are exacted to sufficiently refine the cerebral tenement for manifestation of cosmic consciousness. Untying the cord of breath which binds the soul to the body, kriya serves to prolong life and enlarge the consciousness to infinity. The yoga method overcomes the tug of war between the mind and the matter-bound senses, and frees the devotee to re-inherit his eternal kingdom. He knows his real nature is bound neither by physical encasement nor by breath, symbol of the mortal enslavement to air, to nature's elemental compulsions. Introspection, or sitting in the silence, is an unscientific way of trying to force apart the mind and senses, tied together by the life force. The contemplative mind, attempting its return to divinity, is constantly dragged back toward the senses by the life currents. Kriya, controlling the mind directly through the life force, is the easiest, most effective, and most scientific avenue of approach to the infinite. In contrast to the slow, uncertain bullock cart theological path to God, kriya may justly be called the airplane route. The yogic science is based on an empirical consideration of all forms of concentration and meditation exercises. Yoga enables the devotee to switch off or on, at will, life current from the 5 sense telephones of sight, sound, smell, taste, and touch. Attaining this power of sense disconnection, the yogi finds it simple to unite his mind at will with divine realms or with the world of matter. No longer is he unwillingly brought back by the life force to the mundane sphere of rowdy sensations and restless thoughts. Master of his body and mind, the kriya yogi ultimately achieves victory over the last enemy, death. So shalt thou feed on death, that feeds on men, and death once dead, there's no more dying then. The life of an advanced kriya yogi is influenced, not by effects of past actions, but solely by directions from the soul. The devotee thus avoids the slow, evolutionary monitors of egoistic actions, good and bad, of common life, cumbrous and snail-like to the eagle hearts. The superior method of soul living frees the yogi who, shorn of his ego prison, tastes the deep air of omnipresence. The thraldom of natural living is, in contrast, set in a pace humiliating.